I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Brooke Masters. Joining me in the studio is the FT's banking editor, Patrick Jenkins, Charlene Goff, the retail banking correspondent, and Daniel Schaefer, the investment banking correspondent. This week, we'll take a look at HSBC's results, which aren't bad for a bank.
Both on the micro and the macro, the kind of message was calm and steady as she goes, if you like.
We'll discuss the likely bailout of Spanish bank Bankia and the ongoing Eurozone crisis.
One of the essential things that need to happen for the Eurozone crisis being solved is the recapitalization of banks in Spain.
And finally, we'll look at the online lender Wonga and its decision to start lending to small businesses.
People are using them. I mean, it's just whether small businesses are going to go down that route, because it's a bit different to borrow several thousand than a couple of hundred pounds.
Let's start with HSBC. Patrick, what do they have to say for us today?
Well, as you say, the results for the first quarter aren't bad for a bank. Their underlying pre-tax profit was up 25%, roughly, to close to $7 billion. And, you know, the markets responded pretty positively, sending the shares up today. They had some interesting kind of calming messages. I think the kind of key thing that came out of the investor and analyst and journalist calls this morning were the kind of point that Stuart Gulliver, the chief executive, was trying to sound very calm over the issues around the Eurozone. You know, they're quite big. Despite being an emerging markets bank, they're quite big in some of the key markets in the Eurozone, notably France, where we've obviously just had a new socialist president of the Republic elected. And he was trying to calm nerves about that. He was also trying to calm nerves about the Greek situation and saying that he thought the Eurozone could withstand a Greek exit from the Eurozone. So, I mean, I think both on the micro and the macro, the kind of message was calm and steady as she goes, if you like.
Like everybody else, HSBC has a PPI problem. Did they also have to take extra money?
Yes, they did. And that was particularly interesting because they also upped their provision in February, so only a couple of months ago. And already they've had to take another hit. And it's a big one this time. It's an extra $500 million. And for HSBC, which was one of the smaller providers of PPI, that's a chunky uplift. Its original provision was only about $700 million. So significant increase there when you think that Lloyds, for example, put aside £375 million, but its original provision was £3.2 billion. So HSBC has been hit quite hard by this. I think even only a couple of weeks ago, they weren't intending to make another provision so quickly, but obviously they've seen all of the other banks, bar Santander UK, do it this time around, and they thought, I guess, that they would take a cautious stance.
One of the interesting things on that, Charlene, was that HSBC has always kind of argued that they were far less aggressive than any of the other banks, that they'd stopped selling it so early, and that therefore their proportion of policies that had been missold and could be eligible for compensation was likely to be less than the other banks. I think they kind of tacitly acknowledged today that the proportion's going to be about the same,
right?
That they, you know, maybe were just as aggressive as everybody else.
It's just taken a bit longer for their customers to wake up to it.
Maybe.
Do you think there are other lessons we should take from the HSBC results?
I think broadly they are, as I say, kind of encouraging. They're probably not representative particularly of the UK banking sector, given how much of their business comes from emerging markets, which are largely still booming. It was an interesting blip in Brazil where they had to increase their provisions quite significantly. But that, you know, again, Mr. Gulliver was trying to calm any kind of over concern about that performance there. And I think probably, you know, with some justification. So read across, I think, you know, we've had the kind of steer from Standard Chartered, which Charlene wrote about last week. And I think, you know, we get far less detail from Standard Chartered, but it felt like a similar kind of tone from there. So I suppose the kind of broader lessons that we'd be looking at really is you know, on the kind of macro picture for Europe. And I suppose, you know, if Mr. Gulliver's right there about things not being a disaster area, then, you know, we should all be a bit heartened.
We've also got HSBC's second annual Investor Day coming up next week. So I think we'll get a bit more detail around some of the intricacies of the business, particularly on costs. Analysts are looking for a bit more detail there. HSBC is trying to implement quite a radical cost-cutting structure and get the cost-to-income ratio down. Now, it made quite good headway on that in the first quarter of the year, but analysts are not convinced they can keep that up for the remainder of the year, and they think there could be some bad news maybe coming next week on that as Mr. Gulliver kind of eases that target a little bit.
Yeah, we'll have to see on that. They were very reticent to answer too many strategic questions today, but one thing they did say and kind of point towards deliberately was they talked about a run rate of annualized cost savings of $2 billion, which is kind of extrapolating what they did last year combined with an annualized version of what they did in the first quarter, which would suggest that they're pretty confident they can maintain that pace for the rest of the year. But as you say, we'll get more detail next week.
From there, shall we move on to yesterday's events in Spain? While the UK was on bank holiday, the Spanish government decided to have a bank bailout, or it certainly looks like it's headed that way. Patrick, can you tell us what happened with Bankia?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is the bank that was kind of very artificially, very politically knocked together out of seven regional banks about a year ago or more, and then controversially floated last summer. I say controversially because this was, you know, right in the grip of the Eurozone crisis at a time when Spain actually was at the centre of the storm, and they kind of pressed ahead with this float, mostly getting the money from retail investors in Spain who arguably were not the best informed to make this decision about whether to invest their life savings in a big bank, which is not particularly healthy. But yeah, I mean, it's all come home to roost, really. It seems we still got no official statement on this, other than to have been told that the CEO, Rodrigo Rato, the former head of the IMF, a former Spanish finance minister who'd been drafted in as a kind of, you know, political figurehead to run this institution, he has left. He's being replaced by the former head of BBVA, so a commercial banker who, you know, really should know what he's doing. But other than that, we have no details of the long-rumoured bailout that we're going to get of Bankia, up to 10 billion euros supposedly being injected in some form, which is why I say the Bankia float was so controversial. Basically, it looks like a lot of those equity investors who only came in last summer could well be wiped out, or at least very severely diluted, depending on the form of this injection. We'll probably get more news on it on Friday this week. There's a board meeting of the bank then, and we suspect we'll get kind of more detail about what kind of bailout to expect.
Now, Bankia is not actually a household name outside of Spain, and other than those very unhappy retail investors, it's not that big a deal. But what's the read across from this kind of sudden collapse of Bankia? Daniel, can you give us a sense of what we should be thinking about for the rest of the Eurozone?
I think it's sort of, again, make or break time for the Eurozone, in the sense that everybody knows the Spanish Tier 2 banks need some sort of support eventually, and the banking system there will have to be capitalized, and this is one of the essential things that need to happen for the Eurozone crisis being solved. This is the recapitalization of banks in Spain, where they had a property bubble bursting, and actually the level of bad loans as proportion to total lending has risen to the highest level in 18 years. So in that sense, it might be good news if the Spanish government is willing to do that, and if they get the backing from the other European governments, because the question is whether Spain will be able to afford a more broader bailout of its banks.
I think that's the key question, really, is Bankia did stand out like a sore thumb in the sense that its woes were that much greater than everybody else's. But I think two questions come out of that. One is, does Spain have enough resources under its own steam to solve this problem? Central bankers there insist that they can come to some kind of arrangement, although it's, as I say, until Friday, we're probably not going to find out what that might be. And if they don't have their own resources, then, you know, you kind of spook international investors yet again, because everyone's worried about, does Spain have to go to Brussels to kind of seek some kind of bailout, even if it's only targeted at financing a bank refinancing. And then the other question is how broad this is in Spain, whether Bankia is the only troubled institution, and probably, well, it's not the only troubled institution, but it's probably the only big institution that is so troubled. So there are a few other little cajas, these regional savings banks, that need to be resolved. But I think, you know, for the time being, at least the big players in Spain, Santander and BBVA, thanks to partly to their international diversification, they've got a far healthier balance sheet and profit flow. But, you know, the trouble is that the longer this uncertainty and lack of clarity goes on, the more damaging it is to everybody.
Do you think there's a risk that Spain ends up as a much, much larger Ireland? Is there enough money?
I think ultimately that is exactly the danger, and the issue in Ireland was clearly dealt with far, far earlier. You know, it's easy to forget exactly what was done and when it was done. And Charlene, you covered it in great detail, but the creation of NAMA as a kind of a public sector bad bank is certainly a model that the Spaniards have looked at. Whether this is what they should do, they should put all their bad property assets into some kind of centralized institution.
But it's amazing that they're only considering that now.
Yeah.
We're like more than 4 years on. I mean, exactly. Ireland did this so quickly. You know, we've had like NAMA 2 already, and that seems like a sort of distant memory, the establishment of that. And suddenly we're writing stories saying that Spain are eyeing up the NAMA model. I mean, it's just kind of unbelievable how slow they've been to react.
I think the problem was that they genuinely thought that they could manage their way through this in the short term, that it would be a 1 year, 2 year thing that they would bounce back from, and that their kind of pretty cautious way of insisting that banks provision for kind of general problems would have been enough to get them through this, you know, these kind of so-called general provisioning requirements, which most other banks in other countries don't have as a kind of buffer, but they just ate through it so quickly and weren't able to build them back up again. That's been the problem.
And then the crisis has gone on far longer than anyone thought it would. And, you know, it seems that we're almost back to square one in Greece to some extent, with people now getting concerned today that they
that
won't
no
be able to get
be
the
formed.
Latest tranche of bailout funds. So.
Yeah, I guess it also presages another presumably not very good quarter for most of the European banks, because, I mean, what we've heard so far already was that April was a pretty bad month compared to the first quarter, which was a pretty decent quarter for them.
Yeah.
And now with, the problems we have in Spain, the problems we have in Greece, and the French election outcome, which will leave France in 1.5 months of being in balance again, you know, in which we will not see a clear direction, because Hollande he will need to display the picture that he's still pushing his election campaign, because he's facing another election in France, which is the parliamentary election. So he will be torn still between the voters and the markets for at least another 1.5 months, and that's just not gonna bode well for markets and for the Eurozone crisis.
Yeah, and not least for the Franco-German relationship, which is key to resolving the Eurozone crisis. Right?
Indeed. I mean, I think what they'll have to do, Merkel and Hollande, is that everybody will have to keep the impression that everybody's giving something, at least until after the election. Then they're really going to decide on what they're going to do. But until then, the picture will look very difficult still.
From that cheerful look forward, we can at least talk about a new business. Wonga, our new payday lending friend, has entered a new business line. Charlene, you want to tell us about it?
Wonga's become quite a familiar brand in the UK in the last year. I mean, largely because it's had this mass scale advertising campaign in London on television channels, and it's sponsoring a number of football clubs here. So it's known really as a short-term expensive lender. So it's providing loans of anything from a couple of days to a few weeks to people who basically can't get credit anywhere else. So people who, you know, have maxed out their credit card or overdraft potentially, and they need some money in the short term. That's what Wonga does. As from today, it is offering loans to small businesses, trying to plug that gap that has, you know, it's also banks have pulled away from that area. But it's quite a controversial one. And we've had some politicians, consumer groups, the Federation of Small Businesses, who I spoke to yesterday, all expressing concern about this development purely because of the rates that Wonga are charging. I mean, they're so much higher than your regular bank loan, up to 2% a week, with a 5% one-off charge on top of that. So
what's that add up to?
Well, over a year. I mean, the year is the maximum term you can take a loan for. So, and the maximum size is £10,000. So I calculated yesterday that that would equate to almost £11,000 in charges on a £10,000 loan.
That's a lot of money.
It is a fairly desperate SME to
I mean, Wonga's, to give them credit, you know, they've said that they are not trying to provide longer term credit. They're not trying to completely fill the void left by bank lending. What they're trying to do is solve businesses' immediate cash flow problems. So, for instance, and this is, you know, increasingly happening in the recession, that customers have been late paying an invoice, or they've been assured that they will get some kind of funding from a bank and it's taken 3 months rather than two to come through. You know, those kind of short term issues. The Federation of Small Businesses was saying that actually, if, you know, a business was regularly having to turn to something like Wonga, you would ask them to look very carefully at the viability of their business.
You wonder, I guess, I mean, this is clearly them taking advantage both of the squeeze of the recession and also the fact that the big banks are not able to or not willing to extend SME credit and to the level that people want it. I suppose the take-up level at Wonga will give us some sense about whether the perpetual PR battle between the banks who say we will lend to decent SMEs with good business plans and the SMEs who say that the banks are charging too much and aren't lending. If people really do go to Wonga, that would suggest that the banks really aren't lending.
Yes, it would. And, you know, there are benefits. I mean, the big one is that Wonga are promising funds in as little as 15 minutes, you know, from application, it's in your account. You know, the maximum they're saying is 24 hours. So that's vastly different to the banks, which can take weeks, if not months, to process or even approve a loan. So that's what they're selling themselves on. You know, it's going to be quick, it's going to be easy, it's all online, and you'll get the money in your account the same day. Yes, it's expensive, but they see that's a premium service that people will pay for. And if you look at the experience they've had on consumers, they've done over 4 million loans to date in 4 years. So people are using them. I mean, it's just whether small businesses are going to go down that route, because it's a bit different to borrow several thousand than a couple of £100.
I suppose one question, just to come back to your point, Brooke, is this really SME lending? It feels, if it's a maximum loan of £10,000, it feels very much like a kind of sole trader, kind of, you know, micro business, yeah. Really. It probably doesn't actually address the issue of SME kind of supply and demand, I suspect. It's a tiny little sector that's maybe underserved, but it's not really
No, and actually we are seeing a number of alternative lenders try and come into the sort of invoice financing space, where they'll, you know, we've seen some peer-to-peer groups try and address this and say, you know, they'll buy invoices from companies, you know, and take a fee. So it's a similar sort of thing, like it's just mopping up that short-term need. And I'm sure there are businesses out there that, you know, just can't survive because they can't get the money for a couple of weeks. But it just seems like, you know, they might be going down the rabbit hole a little bit. And it's definitely not a cycle you want to end up relying on, because, you know, as well as the high interest rates and high arrangement fees, of course, the penalty fees are exorbitant, and you start missing a weekly repayment and suddenly the costs spiral into, you know, way more than 100% a year.
In a way, this is shadow banking writ small, where we can all understand it. I mean, this is what happens when you have alternatives to bank lending. Will the Eurozone spiral us into some new crisis where we're all using Wonga? Who knows? That's it for this week. All that's left is to thank Patrick and Charlene and Daniel for their contribution, and you for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all the latest banking stories at www.ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney. Till next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.